Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll hear an interview with Marty Konlisk, a Chicago-area television producer, to discuss a film festival in Japan and his own legal fight over video recording protests in Chicago. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The House Commerce Committee held a hearing last week to investigate the impact of online behavioral advertising on consumer privacy. Companies like Microsoft and Google and advertising agencies routinely sift through consumers' online information to help target their advertising. Several members of Congress expressed their concern about these tactics. Representative Rick Boucher, a Democrat from Virginia, has been working with Republican Congressman Cliff Stearns of Florida on a bipartisan bill that would protect consumers. Most legislators agree that consumers need to be better informed about who's using their personal information and how that information is being used. Republican Joe Barton of Texas.
I think it's a big deal if somebody tracks where you go and what you look at without your personal approval. We wouldn't like that in the non-internet world, and I personally don't like it in the internet world.
Jeff Chester testified at the hearing. Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy and has been working on online privacy issues for 15 years.
The online marketing industry has created this incredibly complex and far-reaching system designed to collect every little piece about us based on what we do online, the content we like and might not like, how much we put in our shopping carts, what we're willing to spend and not spend, you know, tracking us on a kind of 24/7 basis.
Chester says that the goal of this well-oiled commercial surveillance is to send us very powerful targeted messages based on neuroscience and brain research to bypass the conscious mind and work in our unconscious minds.
We will be asked to buy things as mundane as books, toasters, and clothes, but also to influence, and I think this is the key issue, influence our perceptions and our behaviors when it comes to financial and health matters and increasingly even politics.
Online commerce is here to stay, and it needs to thrive, says Chester. But it needs to be done in a way that gives consumers control over the information that is gathered. Public interest and consumer groups believe there should be no behavioral targeting without user consent.
The individual has to understand how that data is going to be collected, how it's going to be used. They need to be able to make decisions about how that profile is to be constructed, whether they want their ethnic information or financial information included in the profile. Look, the online marketers have created this ingenious, world-class digital data collection system. Surely they can also figure out a way to protect our privacy in the process.
And now for a Media Minutes Week in Media Roundup. On Tuesday, Julius Genachowski was sworn in as the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. The Senate voted unanimously to confirm Genachowski late last week. Media reform advocates and public interest organizations welcomed the new chairman as someone who will, as Seattle Times editor Ryan Blethen writes, put citizens before big media. Genachowski dove straight into a busy week, traveling to an event in Erie, Pennsylvania, where he talked about rural broadband access and the FCC's national broadband plan to connect everyone in the country to high-speed internet. He chaired his first official meeting with the commission on Thursday.
And in other news, the Personal Democracy Forum took place in New York City this week and brought together more than 1,000 participants. Free Press Executive Director Josh Silver was a featured speaker at the event.
The Personal Democracy Forum is a gathering of journalists, politicians, activists, technologists, and it really explores how the intersection of technology and politics are changing our media and political landscape. One of the striking events at the conference was a panel where I sat down with the leaders from AT&T and the Cable Association. We talked about Obama's broadband agenda and what's next in the internet. And it was striking to see how there's consensus amongst the people in the audience and people across the country that we must get fast, affordable, neutral internet into every home and business in this country. And that key to that is breaking open competition in the internet service provider market. The fact is cable and phone companies have been doing the very opposite for well over a decade, getting rid of the requirements that allowed competitors on phone lines to offer internet, getting rid of municipalities' rights to offer internet to their citizens. The end of the cable telco duopoly is near if we can move some of these policies that Free Press and our allies are trying to promote in the Congress and at the Federal Communications Commission.
You can find out more about the Personal Democracy Forum at personaldemocracy.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with Marty Konlisk, a Chicago-area television producer, to discuss a film festival in Japan and his own legal fight over video recording protest in Chicago. The following interview was recorded on Wednesday, July 1st, 2009. We are joined by Marty Konlisk. Marty is a co-producer with the Chicago area television program Labor Beat and has also recently gone on a trip to Japan. Marty, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitchell. Thank you for having me on.
Tell us a little bit more about Labor Beat for folks who may be unfamiliar with the program.
Labor Beat's been on Chicago Cable, CAN TV, for 22 years now, since 1986 or so. And I've been around 16 of those years. And we just put our 580 show on. We're on every 2 weeks. We repeat four times on Channel 19. And it's an exciting show. We do picket lines, demonstrations, other working class issue kind of issues.
Kind of like as a news program?
Yeah, it's kind of a magazine format. Mm-hmm. We try to go to the event and get them on TV as soon as possible. That's our goal.
Very cool. And you also recently went to a festival about video that took place in Japan. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, I was uniquely honored to be invited by some of the organizers of this event. They're Japan Peace TV, which is up on the internet. You can Google that. And Zenko, Z-E-N-K-O, which is the Japanese Peace Organization. And they invited me over to tour Japan on a five-city film festival along with Mr. Salak Al-Jabbar of Sana TV, S-A-N-A. People should Google that, too. And he works out of Baghdad, Iraq. And it was quite a thrill and an honor to move around with Mr. Salak and visit Japan. I have a lot of good feelings about it.
What was the festival that you were a part of?
It was the International Video Festival Against War and Poverty, and I was invited because probably for the last 6 years, most of my efforts at Labor Beat have been pointed towards anti-war work because I consider war the greatest of anti-labor device of all time, and so I've gotten some note and. We're big in Japan. They get it. They get Labor Beat in Japan. You know, we have a hard time in getting it out in Peoria, Illinois, but in Japan, Labor Beat's big.
How do you account for that?
We got connected with Japan Peace TV through our work through the Sen High School community protest against the military academy and the military academies in the Chicago public schools. We did several stories on that. And Japan picked up on that, and it seems to me, I'm not quite nailed on this, but it seems to me the teachers' union is a lot behind the peace movement in Japan. Now we have a whole generation of demilitarized nation. They weren't allowed to have a military after World War II, and the Japanese teachers' union, whose slogan is formed after World War II, and his slogan is, "Never again shall we have our children die on the battlefield." And so the peace movement's kind of fueled by this. They there's a movement not to stand for their war songs, they call their national anthems, that were introduced in the 80s and pushed on school graduation ceremonies, things like that. Some teachers don't stand up for that, and they're getting punished for that. So I asked them to send a letter to Marilyn Stewart here in town to remind them of that slogan and other things.
For listeners who might be familiar out of Chicago, who might be listening to this on the internet, remind us who Marilyn Stewart is.
Oh, she's the head of the Chicago Teachers Union here in town. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything. Yeah, teachers can talk about her, not me. But anyway, so we met in Okinawa. An hour and a half later, we were talking at Okinawa University. And Labor Beat video was a part of it. Mr. Salek's video was people living in a garbage dump within sight of the Green Zone in Baghdad. And I was floored. I was supposed to get up and talk after this video. I was extremely mortified by these conditions these people lived in. And all the images and all the videos that he showed throughout this trip were extremely hard to bear somewhat. You know, being a born American, I feel I'm responsible for something. Especially traveling with him through the Hiroshima Peace Museum. That was a unique experience that I'll always treasure. And the next day on our way back to Osaka from Hiroshima, Mr. Salek said in the cab that those pictures in Hiroshima reminded him of the conditions of Baghdad today. That one really hurt.
Particularly since the United States has a particularly direct role in what wound up happening, of course.
I was kind of the only American in this whole entourage, and I felt a lot of weight there.
Give us a sense of the scale of how big the festival is and how many people were attending it.
Well, as I say, we were in Okinawa. We were in Hiroshima. The biggest day was in Osaka University. There were 200-300 people. It was fueled by the student organizers there, who were just tremendous to be around. And that was a big festival, and I'd like to talk about the festival itself a little bit.
Sure.
And then we went to the next day is we went to Kyoto, where there was about 100 more people, in a very nice theater setting. And so Mr. Salek and I showed our videos all around Japan, and Japan may very well have a very key hinge role in these peace movements, world international peace. I was really very hopeful that way.
How do you figure that Japan's going to play a key role in peace movements around the world?
Diplomacy, and it's a safe place where people can get together, as far as I could tell. And they have several steps ahead of us as far as peace movement and an understanding of military and society. You know.
What were some of the other videos that were shown at the festival? Was it just you and Salek Al-Jabbar? Were there others?
Well, I'll talk about the other smaller ones. We showed a Palestinian protest video of Labor Beat, and Mr. Salek showed it was a video of a school of 12, 15-year-old boys, and all their fathers were killed or disappeared, and it was the interviews with them. But our featured videos were, his was a stroll through a spinal column damaged Iraqi population from bullets and bombs and shrapnel and whatever else.
So we got like a medical documentary almost, right. It sounds like.
Right, you know, and their struggles of rehab. And American people need to see these images. And a Labor Beat feature was Aaron and Erbil, which is up on Blip TV. That's Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, and Erbil is E-R-B-I-L. That's in Iraq, Erbil, Iraq. And Aaron Hughes was a veteran, member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And he went back in March to a trade union conference there in Erbil, Iraq, and he apologized to the Iraqi people as a soldier for pointing his weapons at their communities. Labor Beat had him back as soon as he got back. We had him interviewed. We had his radio interview up 2 days later. We had his his video up on the web, and a week later we saw this as a huge international story. And the Japan Peace TV did too. But we can't move this story anywhere where an American soldier goes back to a hostile country and apologizes.
Within the American media, you mean?
We can't move this story anywhere in any other media circles. It's a story that should be told. But I was told on two occasions in two different places that the reason why they were so taken with Aaron Hughes, the Japanese people were so taken with Aaron Hughes, was because not only did he apologize, because one lady explained to me that Japanese people apologize all the time, but when he apologized, he also took responsibility for his actions. And saying that to the Iraqi people really impressed the Japanese people about Aaron Hughes.
With what you've been describing so far of locales of where some of the films that have been shown have been set, they're usually like global hotspots, the United States, Iraq, Palestine, but this is a film conference in Japan. Were there any films by the Japanese about Japan?
I really do want to talk about how this festival was set up.
Sure.
And how everything went off without a hitch, one minor hitch on getting something up on the computer. But his was featured in the morning, mine was featured in the afternoon. But in between all that, they had put a call out for 3-minute videos, blasts. And they got usually 6-minute returns, you know. But what they would do, they would show no more than 4. And then each videographer was there to jump up, and he had 15 or 20 seconds to explain what the video's on. And then they sat down, and the video went on. The next one would jump up, and the video went on. And then after the fourth one, they'd chase everybody out of the room, like, or make you mix around it. They'd make an announcement, like, we're going to give an award to somebody if you want to stick around. You know, you stick around. But anyway, they do this little award thing. It'd fill the day. And then in 10 minutes, they'd all be back in the room. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting was the festival hired a critic, a well-recognized Japanese video, and he would make notes of all these videos. And then before they started the next section, he would get up and critique all the videos. And he'd have them laughing a little bit. He had them engaged. I thought it was a beautiful way to criticize as a group without sniping. Because, let's face it, a lot of the videos weren't technically all that good, you know, but they were people's, you know, they were social justice type of videos, which, you know, we've done for 20 years, but other people, I think, are getting up and doing more and more, you know, showing the injustices in this world. There are so many.
You had mentioned earlier on an entity called Japan Peace TV.
Yes.
This is a television network of some kind?
Well, actually, it's an internet channel.
Okay.
I don't have the site in front of me. You have to Google it. But Japan Peace TV, they are tied together with Sana Peace TV. S-A-N-A is the Iraqi, the Baghdad connection there. And so the both of them work together. Yes, it's an internet channel. And it runs on micro donations. So we're intrigued in how this works.
People will make donations, say, through the internet.
Yeah, I think it's like $5 a year or something.
Wow.
500 yen a year, which is like $4.
And then with enough donations, they'll, like, say, if you get, you know, through the internet, that makes it a lot more feasible that, like, say,
well,
if you get 1,000 people to each donate $5, that's $5,000 that you can, in some operations, even though a lot of bigger media might deem that insulting. A lot of smaller operations, especially where they run on budgets of like zero, can really go far with that.
So I had two different cities I had to explain cable access. Because the idea of taking a slice of corporate pie in Japan is just, there's a lot of concepts that, in Tokyo, I told them that, don't worry, Chicago doesn't want the games. Believe me, the cities, cities don't want the Olympics. And I had 30 Japanese people stunned. What do you mean they don't want the Olympics? You know, so they have ideas, and I was treated royally. I was treated top notch, and when they asked me the last day of the festival, the last question I got was, you know, what did you think of our festival? And I said, well, the amount of work that went into it, and the fact that you people got along so well, all across the breadth of the country. They all pulled for the same idea that this festival was going to go off, and it really was infectious. It was beautiful.
Going back for a moment just to the point regarding the Olympics, the 2016 Summer Olympics, both Tokyo and Chicago are finalists for the bid. There has been organized opposition in Chicago, most notably the No Game Chicago Coalition has been working.
Yes.
Is there anything to your knowledge in Japan or in Tokyo that might be critical, or is it just entirely rah-rah for yay Olympics?
I saw nothing except that last night, like I explained. And then I had to explain why I didn't. I don't want it on philosophical grounds, and there was another argument with them about one person doesn't deserve to win and the rest of us be losers. I don't like the spelling bee as a model of society.
Right,
you know, so.
Right.
But, yeah, yeah.
What was, it would seem that this, especially having been crystallized and very fruitful and positive as an example, is there a sense of that, you may not be able to know this for maybe years, but could this happen again? Could another conference or international video festival against war and poverty be organized at some point in the future? Any of the organizers you mentioned talk about this as a possibility?
Well, certainly what I can tell is the farewell party was a really great time. And the spirits in the room were really high and excited for another one, yes. We'll have to see. I think we should have more video showings. I think around town or anywhere else, we should get these images out of Baghdad that should be seen by Americans, that Mr. Selleck so bravely is trying to produce. The last two general managers of Sana TV are missing, presumed dead, and one was his uncle, and he very well might be dead. Another point I made a couple times is I'm involved in a lawsuit here in Chicago that has to do with free speech and press rights and everything. This could be a very important thing, so I thought that was important, you know, at one time, the subpoena and all the legal process and all that. Mr. Selleck, he goes back doing the same work I do, and he very well may be killed for it.
If we can turn a little bit to this lawsuit that you had mentioned, can you elaborate on this for listeners who may be unfamiliar with it? What lawsuit, and who are you suing?
Now, I'm a third party in it, and the city is claiming that I'm not a reporter, I'm a propagandist, even though I've been doing Labor Beat for 16 years. And obviously, I'm recognized internationally as being a reporter. So I look at it as just another brick in the wall for all the independent video media producers out there. I quit taking it like personal as far as me, but they wanted all my raw footage of anti-war activity, the city did, for all time. And the subpoena was very extensive, and I got some good pro bono legal work, and they kind of beat it off, but I'm going to have to give something up, you know, and it's just another brick. Just another chink that takes down the what we call this independent media. It could go very, very bad for us.
When did you get subpoenaed?
In October.
October 2008.
Yeah.
And the city was basically asking you for everything you've ever done for the last 16 years video related?
No, 6 years for the anti-war work, specifically anti-war work.
And you're fighting the subpoena?
Yes.
And any idea how long it may take for the future ramifications of this?
No, as I say, I'm kind of a third party in it. I'm not the defendant or plaintiff, yeah. So I have no idea. It's just creeping along. But it doesn't spell well. I mean, if I could just rush to the worst-case scenario as I see it, even though I may have spoke here, but I just want to be clear that if this goes down like the city wants it to go down, that would make anybody with a video camera at a public event an investigator for the Chicago Police Department. They would subpoena your tape, and you would have to give it to them because you were there. It's pretty powerful stuff.
I can also imagine that something like this subpoena would be, the intent of it would be to try to dissuade others who may want to serve witness in whatever capacity they can. Do you feel that that's the case as well, that you're being made an example of in some sense?
Like I say, another brick in the wall. I mean, there was a case before me, McKevitt case. There's going to be a case behind me. You know, that builds up this wall that you're going to have some sort of state-approved license to be a journalist. You know, or, you know, approved to be there with a camera. You know, that's how I see the worst-case scenario as it's going, but, you know.
And such an approval, of course, will come with a hefty price, no doubt that being of the freedom that you can record. Within LaborBeat, I imagine you have a fair degree of freedom to be able to record whatever it is that you want.
Yeah, like I say, we mostly do public event, protest, demonstration, things like that. You know, and I'm finding out that there's more what we might think of as reporter rights in Illinois than there is in the federal government, and that's where this case is in the federal government also. So, federal trial.
I think it might be important to try to elaborate on some of those rights, especially since this will broadcast in Chicago and in Illinois. What are some of the, where's the difference here, if you can elaborate on that, between federal and local as far as rights goes?
I'll only talk about what I've learned.
Okay.
You know, please double check me. But it boils out of this Posner guy, Judge Posner.
Richard Posner.
Yes, and he made a ruling in this, what's called the McKevitt case, and also Conway's research in the Burge case also plays into all of this stuff.
To John Burge,
yes.
Former Chicago police torturer.
Right.
Right.
So all of these cases had some sort of nick in it about the subpoena and getting the reporter's notes or getting the audio interview with McKevitt. He didn't sign a release, all this nebulous kind of stuff. It just chinks down the idea of you can publicly be a reporter, you know. So that's how I'm viewing it. But again, it is the war machine, it is the war effort, it is the war that is putting both Mr. Salek, father of 11 children, in danger from the United States Army and the military and anything else going on over there, trying to be put a video show on, a satellite show, and me, and these legal, petty legal headaches. But it's the war machine that puts us both in these positions.
But there's also something inspiring to be said about resistance to not only to continue what you've been doing, encourage others to do likewise, but also to steal a line from a famous song, Fight the Power.
We move off of emotion, and video is emotional. And the video image is that we are very controlled. And to have the freedom that we have in LaborBeat right now, being taken away nonetheless, it still exists. And to see the faces of the Iraqi people, see that lady in the garbage dump explain that she was a nurse 6 years ago with an apartment and a car, and she's been living in a garbage dump for 4 years. You know, you're moved. You're moved to do something, or you're moved to be ashamed. What one are you going to be, you know? So we need to help Sana TV get these images out to the American people. They're trying. They're under extreme duress to do that.
And for folks who may be listening who want to do something but aren't sure what would you recommend?
Well, I don't have anything in the works right now, but I do want to start at least getting offers of some equipment or some sort of inquiries, and we can take it from there. I guess punch it up on your computer, Sana TV, Japan Peace TV's, laborbeat.org, and start researching who exactly I'm talking about and who we want to help, and then you'd be more comfortable about it. But that's really what I got to say.
We've been speaking with Marty Conlisk. He is a co-producer of the Chicago-based labor news magazine LaborBeat, and has also been a recent invitee to the first international video festival against war and poverty, which he also discussed in this interview. Marty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was an interview with Marty Konlisk, recorded on Wednesday, July 1st, 2009. To learn more about the TV program Labor Beat, go online to www.laborbeat.org. That's spelled LaborBeat.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.